Women, once celebrated as an essential half of spiritual enlightenment, had been banished from the temples of the world. There were no female Orthodox rabbis, Catholic priests, nor Islamic clerics. The once hallowed act of Eros Gamos, the natural sexual union between man and woman, through which each became spiritually whole, had been recast as a shameful act. Holy men, who had once required sexual union with their female counterparts to commune with God, now feared their natural sexual urges as the work of the devil, collaborating with his favorite accomplice. The days of the goddess were over. The pendulum had swung. Mother Earth had become man's world, and the gods of destruction were taking their toll. The male ego had spent two millennia running unchecked by its female counterpart.
Well, that's Dan Brown's version of history. He would like to recast Christianity as originally a goddess religion. It's all been covered up. That's the premise, or part of the premise. He's reading from his own novel there, The Da Vinci Code, of his popular novel, soon to be a no doubt a blockbuster film. We're talking about the canonical gospels versus the Gnostic gospels. Much of Dan Brown's claim are tied up in these Gnostic, so-called Gnostic gospels. Dr. James Veltz is our guest, professor of New Testament and director of the graduate studies at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. He, along with others, will be speaking at a special presentation titled Discernment for Da Vinci tomorrow night at 7 in Warner Auditorium on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. And everybody is invited to attend that. That's tomorrow night at 7 in Warner Auditorium. That's the main auditorium there on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. Before we go on with our conversation, let's go back to the phones and talk with Jeff, who's been waiting in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania. Jeff, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, yes. I had a question about the Apostolic Fathers. I know they quoted the New Testament, but I was just curious if you actually added up how much of the New Testament did they quote, maybe not by number of verses, but amount of books. And I know since they knew the apostles, that's a very big testimony for the authenticity of the New Testament that we don't really use that much.
Thank you very much, Jeff. It's a great question, in fact. How would you ballpark it? If you go to that second and third generation of church fathers who are quoting the scriptures, before the scriptures are, you know, in that period of time before the second century, how much do they actually end up quoting via sermons, letters, their own epistles, things like that?
Well, that's actually pretty amazing, and that, by the way, is an excellent question that the caller phoned in. I happened to be looking, just in preparation for this show the other night, at Clement's first epistle, which he writes from Rome to the Corinthians. Now, what's interesting about this is about 95. In that letter, he quotes Paul all over the place. So clearly, and it's not only 1 Corinthians. I mean, he's got quotes from Philippians and stuff like this. So clearly, this had become a body, as I said, the Apostolicon, a body of books that people referred to. Now, let's go to some of the other apostolic things, like the Didache, the teaching of the 12 apostles. That's about 115. And the epistles of Ignatius. They will generally, Todd, quote Matthew, Luke, not Mark so much, parts of Paul, but I can tell you this from reading these, they do not quote any Gnostic Gospels. They do not quote things like the Shepherd of Hermas or something like that. They don't quote any of these other things. Now, one of the reasons is, these things weren't actually around at that time. The Gnostic Gospels only arose at about 150. So the caller is right to push the focus on where we're looking pre-150. When you do that, you find a real lack of these other kinds of sources.
Let's talk about some of these Gnostic Gospels. You have one before you, the Gospel of Judas. If someone walks by a bookstore, they're as likely to see that book sitting out with the bestsellers as they see the latest John Grisham novel or something like that. How would you characterize the message of the Gospel of Judas? It's gotten a lot of press lately. And if you would, quote a few passages from us, familiarize our listeners with what this thing really says.
Well, I just received, Todd, a mailing here from Random House with a special examination offer for professors of the Gospel of Judas. And here's what it says. Here is the long-awaited gospel told from the perspective of Judas Iscariot, long understood as history's ultimate traitor. However, far from being a villain, the Judas that emerges in its pages is actually a hero, Jesus' chosen one. Now, I think if I were just to ask you, and you probably, you know this well enough to answer this correctly, but just let your mind go back a little bit. Before you saw anything about the Gospel of Judas, just saw the press reports, wouldn't you have thought that this is a book that tells sort of the story of the ministry of Jesus and the place of Judas in it?
Oh, certainly. That's exactly what I would assume it was.
Right. Well, that's exactly what it's not. What it in fact is, I'll read you the very first verse, the secret account of the revelation that Jesus spoke in conversation with Judas Iscariot during a week, 3 days before he celebrated Passover. All this is a conversation between Judas and Jesus, just for a couple of days in Passover week. There's conversation, and the thing ends with the betrayal, and that's it. So the first point we would want to make is this is not a gospel in any sense like the gospels we have, where you have something about a narrative of the life of Jesus. In fact, almost all of the gospels that are Gnostic gospels are what my colleague Jeff Kloa inceremoniously dubs talking heads. That is to say, Jesus stands and says lots of stuff. Now, in the Gospel of John, we know in the middle of the Gospel, Jesus prays to his Father. We have about a chapter. We are talking here about chapter after chapter after chapter, and that's all you get. The most famous of the Gospels is the Gospel of Thomas, which was discovered at Nag Hammadi in Egypt in 1945, written in Coptic. And that gospel is, in fact, only sayings. It's all it is. There isn't anything else. There's at least a little bit of narrative in this one, like a few verses. But this is the first thing all of the listeners have to realize. The Gnostic gospels tend to be talking heads, and they do not have the narrative, the story of Jesus coming for the redemption of the world and actually having a ministry, dying and rising again, and so on.
Why did the early Gnostics Gnosticism is a heresy that really infects almost every Semitic religion. I mean, it infects many other religions. It kind of has a life of its own before Christianity and, of course, after Christianity begins. Why did the early Gnostics, as far as we can tell, write these Gospels that they intended to be their revelation? What were they up to?
Well, I think it's all a fallout of Platonism. That finally, with Plato, you have this great divide between the spiritual world and the material world. And anything that actually commingles in a way that Judaism and Christianity does, commingles the spiritual and the physical or the material world, is simply anathema to people who think like this. Because for Plato, the material world is either, depending on your version, evil or it is an illusion. Similar in some ways to Hinduism in that. And so the story, I would like to introduce something here in what we're saying. I think this is important for the listeners to hear. That the grand narrative, let me use that phrase, the grand narrative, that is to say the big story of what happened from the beginning of the world until the end of Gnosticism is way different than the Christian grand narrative. And it's really key to see this. Here's the grand narrative of Gnosticism. This is what the stories are generally about. There was a great spirit. This great spirit produced emanations, that is to say, kind of like offshoots or sub-gods. Some of these emanations or offshoots rebelled and fell. And in that rebellion, the material world was created. So the material world is essentially a negative thing, a bad thing. Now, in the material world is captured some of the sparks of this spiritual dimension of the universe. And so what's Gnosticism about? A Redeemer figure comes to Earth, to the material world, to give knowledge to these sparks that are caught in the material world so that they will be able to escape bondage to material things and be reunited with the Great Spirit. Now, this is dumb, you know? And, it's probably not right to characterize it as dumb, but I will tell you this. It's not the Christian grand narrative. Because I want to say for your listeners mm-hmm. what we believe, teach, and confess. Mm-hmm. And that is this, that a good God voluntarily created a good world, that the material world is a good place, and that when we fell, our parents in Adam and Eve fell, that God took steps to redeem that world, and that when he became incarnate in the person of Jesus Christ, it is a testimony to the fact that this world is not evil and that this salvation in Jesus Christ will lead through the resurrection of our Lord in this Easter season, we celebrate that, to the restoration of the created world to what it should be. This is, Todd, a totally different grand narrative. And this is why Gnosticism is not a variation on Christianity. It is a different religion.
So those who say you had this voice version of Christianity versus this version of Christianity competing with one another, part of Dan Brown's premise in the Da Vinci Code, are mischaracterizing Gnosticism. They're not accurately describing what Gnosticism was or is.
That's right. Let me read you a quote from the Gospel of Judas. This is Jesus talking to his disciples. Now listen to this. One day he was with his disciples in Judea, and he found them gathered together and seated in pious observance. When he approached his disciples, seated and offering a prayer of thanksgiving over the bread, he laughed. The disciples said to him, "Master, why are you laughing at our prayer of thanksgiving? We have done what is right." He answered and said to them, "I am not laughing at you. You are not doing this because of your own will, but because it is through this that your God will be praised." Uh-huh. Your God? That's a different God than Jesus and his God. Now, what do you mean it's a different God? Well, now listen to this interchange between Judas and Jesus. And this, folks, is worth the price of admission. Listen to this quote. Judas said to him, "I know who you are and where you have come from. You are from the immortal realm of Barbello, and I am not worthy to utter the name of the one who has sent you." Oh, come on. What is this about the realm of Barbello? Well, here's what it is. From the Great Spirit, two emanations came forth, Barbello and Sophia, wisdom. I mean, most people recognize the name Sophia. Mm-hmm. It's a girl's name, wisdom. Well, wisdom, kind of unfortunately, gave birth to the material universe. Barbello did not. So if Jesus is from the realm of Barbello, he is not entrenched in that material universe. So you see, this is a whole different way of thinking about the nature of God, the nature of the world, and then the nature of salvation, because salvation is essentially revealing information so that you are able to escape from the clutches of the material realm and be reunited with eternal spirit.
So the goal of the Gnostic was to, through knowledge, generally esoteric or secret knowledge, like the Gospel of Judas, something like that, realize that he has the divine spark, fan it to flame, and
yes.
be less and less part of the material world and more part of the spiritual realm.
That's right. And so what they intended to do is to escape and actually go past these other gods and emanations and to be reunited exactly the way you say. Now, the Gospel of, there's no doubt that the Gospel of Thomas is the most famous of these, and it begins the same way. Listen to the first verses. "These are the hidden words that the living Jesus spoke, and Didymus, Judas, Thomas wrote them down. And he said, whoever finds the meaning of these words will not taste death. See? So that is the idea that you are going to be able to escape from all of this. Now, these books actually have huge, schemes, I guess, Todd, that's the best way to say it, schemes whereby gods are produced. For example, I'm reading now from the Gospel of Judas that the great invisible spirit produced a luminous cloud. And he said, let an angel come into being as my attendant. A great angel, the self-enlightened one, emerged from the cloud. Because of him, four other angels came into being from another cloud, and they became attendants for the angelic self. See, this just goes on like this, over and over and over. So the notion, people simply, our listeners, simply have to be aware that we are not talking about an alternative story where you have Jesus going around to Galilee and all the rest. You're talking about the spirit of the self generated and all this. And this is why it is not at all fair to characterize this as an alternative. In fact, let me say this. I think our listeners will be able to resonate to this. The closest thing I know of the relationship between Gnosticism and our Gospels is the way I think it is proper to regard the Mormons. The Mormons are essentially a Gnostic sect. What they have is secret knowledge. You can't go to the temple, Todd. Mm-hmm. You can't go to all of their ceremonies. They have multiple gods. They have release from this world. You get to be god of your own planet and so on like this. Mm-hmm. All of this, and just like the Gnostics, they have additional authoritative documents such as the gold tablets. So that is a Gnostic competing religion to what we have. Another piece of Gnosticism in our culture is the Masonic Lodge, which, again, trades upon secret knowledge and essentially draws this big line between the people who are in the know and will get to the highest order and the rest.
Let's go to the phones again, and we'll start with Andy this time. He calls from Kirkwood. Andy, thank you for being so patient. Welcome to Issues.
So a little of my thunder. They're comparing the Mormons to the Gnostics, but the other thought I had was it sounds an awful lot like Scientology.
Andy, thank you very much. What do you think, Dr. Belts?
He's right on target. Scientology is exactly like this.
So we can find these. Your whole point, Dr. Belts, is it is as ludicrous to assert that these ancient Gnostic Gospels are competing versions of Christianity, as ludicrous as it would be to assert that Mormonism is a competing form of Christianity today.
Yes, and wouldn't you say, Todd, that this is an issue that people have to face today because the Mormons like to characterize themselves that way, as kind of a denomination or something like mm-hmm. this. No, this is exactly the point. They have a different authority structure and so forth. By the way, someone gave a presentation at a pastoral conference I was at recently on Islam. And as I was taking notes on this, Todd, it occurred to me that Islam has some interesting Gnostic tendencies. For example, Jesus taught Islam the secret knowledge, but that Christianity has messed this up so that the public teaching is not the same. They say Jesus did not die on the cross but was taken up. Well, in the Gospel of Judas, he says that Judas will betray him so that he will sacrifice the man that clothes me. Hey, that's something wrong with the material always for the Gnostics, and you want to be able to get rid of that. And it would be true to say, finally, that also for Islam, there is just this intractable problem of the incarnation, that God could actually mess with materiality in human flesh.
In Islam, God is entirely transcendent, and the incarnation flies in the face of this complete and absolute transcendence of God.
Absolutely. Flies completely in the face of that.
Harold is on the line. He is calling from St. Charles. Harold, thank you for being patient.
Yeah, thank you. I understand what I'm about to mention was discussed on a previous program there. Dan Brown, who was also influenced by his wife's thinking, neither one of them are Christians. And they set out there, like Bart Ehrman, to debunk traditional Orthodox Christianity. And in contrast, you know, you have some of the theologians of these bankrupt theological denominations, or their professors also come up with theological rubbish. And I'd like to hear your comments about that.
Thank you very much, Harold. He mentioned Bart Ehrman, who we interviewed a couple months ago. He had written this book where he asserts the same thing with regard to the Council of Nicaea. He asserts that and he makes his case on the basis of textual criticism. He looks at all the variations and he says, well, if it has this many variations, it must not be a reliable text. And therefore, they just had to kind of stamp out the text and say, okay, all these variations are wrong. Here's the authoritative text at the Council of Nicaea. And that's how we got what we call the New Testament. But it can't be reliable because there are too many variations. A case made by a lot of Bible scholars.
Well, that's simply not true. And to get the authoritative word on that, you got to have my colleague Jeff Kloa on, mm-hmm. who is really turning into one of the great text critics in the world. And we'll be able to answer the specifics of the Bart Ehrman things. But I'll tell you this. This is completely wrong on at least two fronts. And number one, there isn't any set text even at any Council of Nicaea or anything like that. So, as a matter of fact, people who like to talk about received text and so on, well, there is no one text where there are no variations of anything. We don't really have that. And not only that, it is certainly true to say that there are some very important variations, but no one should misrepresent this, that the large, large majority of variations are of this status. Then Jesus said to the Pharisees, and the other manuscript has, then Jesus said to the scribes and Pharisees. They're like that. I like to characterize it this way for my class. The variants are not like this, that in some important sentence like John 3:16, there's a not in the middle of it.
Dr. Veltz, we only have 30 seconds. You mentioned at the beginning that the Christians really... Why is it important Christians positively know what did occur, where our scriptures did come from, as opposed to simply... saying, okay, I just know that the Da Vinci Code is wrong. It just seems wrong to me. Why is it important for them to know the positive there? 30 seconds.
I would say for two reasons. Number one, that externally that they are able to give a clear witness to the hope that is within them. And number two, personally, that they're not tossed around by every wind of doctrine, as St. Paul says, but in fact can be sure in their faith that the question marks aren't raised continually with every book that comes.
Dr. James Veltz is professor of New Testament and director of the Graduate Studies Department at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. He will be one of the speakers for a special presentation titled Discernment for Da Vinci tomorrow night at 7 at Werner Auditorium on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. That's tomorrow night at 7 p.m. at Werner Auditorium here on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. It's called Discernment for Da Vinci. Dr. Veltz, thanks.
Thank you.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
What makes this such a unique place is that the Word of God is so central and is proclaimed with such vigor and such clarity at this place.
Dr. Larry Rast on the uniqueness of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Here the scriptures are at the center. The Lutheran confessions as a right exposition of the scriptures are held up for all the world to hear. Here we are concerned about our historical past and being faithful to the proclamation of the gospel as the scriptures give them to us and as the faithful church has delivered those over time. And also we are concerned about preparing servants for the church, pastors who will preach the word and administer the sacrament. So what you have is a community with Christ at the center of all things. And as such, that truly makes this a unique place.
Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. The ongoing debate over the freedom of military chaplains to talk about their faith has prompted a curious claim from the ACLU. The liberal group that appears bent on ridding culture of any public mention of Christianity went to the Air Force Academy to proclaim that the oft-mentioned war on Christians is nothing more than, quote, a myth driven by politics. Terry Phillips says many beg to differ.
New guidelines in the Air Force allow freedom for the expression of faith. It's a change the ACLU is using to promote an agenda of their own, discrediting the suggestion that they're leading a war on Christians in America. Here's retired Major General Bob Dees.
There has been definite agendas by some of these groups, definite cultural warfare.
And he didn't need any time to think of examples.
When we took prayer out of schools, when we took the Ten Commandments off the walls of the schools in 1980.
He's not alone. Michael Medved hosts a conservative radio talk show.
The truth is that this kind of warfare is inevitable, precisely because there is a very profound conflict in values going on.
Escalating attacks on Christian values come from Hollywood, the media, academia, courts, and activist groups like the ACLU. Rick Scarborough is with Vision America.
The use of the word war is not even hyperbole. That literally is what's taking place today. The fact of God in our public schools is taught as theory, and the theory of evolution is taught as fact.
Al Minconi with Minconi Ministries sees bias in the media all the time.
If they're going to do something on a Christian topic, they never do their homework. They have their preconceived ideas on what they think Christianity is.
But they all agree on one thing. You can't win a war by silence or disengagement. For Family News and Focus, I'm Terry Phillips.
A recent Air Force policy discouraged public prayers at routine events and warned superior officers about using personal expressions of faith. For Family News and Focus, I'm Bob.
On the next midday, Living Jubilee, live at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO. Join Joni Harwell and me, Diane Summers. We visit with Dr. Victor Raj from Concordia Seminary, continuing his series on understanding Hinduism. Beverly Lewis talks about her series of books about the Amish called, and this one's called The Englisher. It begins at 11:05, Living Jubilee on AM 850 KFUO.
Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month is a Christ-centered, cross-focused version of The Purpose-Driven Life. It's titled A Theology to Live By, The Practical Luther for the Practicing Christian. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040, or look for the cover of A Theology to Live By on our website, issuesetc.org. A Theology to Live By, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Halfway through the program here, we're going to spend some time with Jennifer Roback Morse. She has often made the connection between no-fault divorce and the disintegration, we should say, of our view of marriage in the United States. Is there a connection between no-fault divorce and the campaign for gay marriage or same-sex unions? We're going to talk about that coming up here in just a moment. Then, in the last hour of the program, starting at 5 o'clock, a very interesting interview with Greg Kokol. I didn't do the interview. This is not an interview I probably would have done. I heard this interview while driving through the southern Illinois countryside, listening to the BBC very early Sunday morning, an interview done on a program called The Interview. Greg Kokol was kind enough to sit with the interviewer there and answer some very tough questions about his views on abortion. We're going to play the entire thing for you. Stop it and start it and get your reaction. Here's a chance to listen to one of our guests, Greg Kokol, one of our very best guests, by the way. Not answering the kind of kind questions that Wilkin asks, because we agree on this issue, but asking the difficult questions from a proponent of abortion. That's coming up here in about a half hour on Issues Etc. Jennifer Roback Morse is a regular guest. She's a fellow at the Acton Institute. She taught economics for 15 years at Yale and George Washington University. And she's a contributor to a new book titled The Meaning of Marriage. Jennifer, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks for having me.
All right, we've made the case many times, you and I, you mostly, that no-fault divorce, this policy and now this kind of legal framework for dissolving marriages that is now so part and parcel of the divorce scene that most people can't imagine what it was like before no-fault divorce, that has contributed largely to the disintegration of marriage in the United States. So if you would, make that case for us briefly, and then let's go on to talk about its relationship, if any, to the gay marriage issue.
Well, Todd, the major relationship, the major impact of no-fault divorce has been to change marriage from a lifelong covenantal union between a man and a woman to a short-term temporary contract that people keep for as long as it pleases them. And in point of fact, it's not even as strong as your average real estate contract, in the sense that people can effectively default on the terms of the contract, whether they're implicit or explicit. People can default with essentially no negative consequence to themselves. So because of no-fault divorce, the courts typically make no inquiry as to marital fault, which means that if a person commits adultery or has substance abuse problems or is doing domestic violence or whatever the case might be, marital fault doesn't enter into whether or not the couple divorces. Of course, they can divorce if one party or the other wants to divorce, they can divorce. But it doesn't particularly bear on what the terms of the divorce settlement will look like. And in fact, sometimes people are told in court that the judge is not interested in hearing anything about marital fault. And so what has happened is that the idea of marriage as a lifelong covenantal union between a man and a woman has been downgraded to a temporary contract that exists as long as both people find it satisfying, and there really isn't any way to bind both parties to continue their obligations to one another. And then what happens in the aftermath of divorce is that typically the father is expelled from the home and is required to pay child support payments. I mean, I'm taking the stereotypical case now here, because obviously there are thousands of divorces and there's a lot of variation, but the father would be required to pay child support and then be entitled to a certain amount of visitation with his children, which is really an extremely minimal performance of the paternal duty and indeed the marital duty, if you think about it. So that a father often gets turned into a combination sperm bank and wallet. And that consequence, what that does is change the behavior of wives and husbands throughout the whole life of the marriage. It doesn't just affect how people behave during divorce and its aftermath. It affects how people treat one another from day one in the marriage, because people know that the marriage can be dissolved for any reason or no reason. And so people behave strategically in all sorts of ways to deal with that through the life of the marriage. So it's had really profound effects on what marriage, in fact, is and how people conduct their everyday lives with respect to each other.
Take us back a little bit, if you could, before we get to the gay marriage issue, and that is, what was divorce legally, even one might say contractually, before the advent of no-fault divorce?
Well, the typical situation would be something like this. The typical situation would be that you would get married, and the expectation would be that both parties would remain within the marriage until death do us part. And you could dissolve the marriage. In virtually every state, you could get a divorce, but it was always for cause. You had to show that something had happened. And, of course, there'd be some variation across the states as to what would be defined as cause, but typically things like domestic violence and alcoholism and gross failure to support and mental cruelty and, you know, those kinds of things would be on the list of fault-based reasons for divorce. So you had to show that somebody had defaulted. And typically what would happen is that there would be an expectation of lifetime support for the wife, in addition to child support, and probably half the property would go to the wife. And what that did, it had a tendency to reduce the incentive, shall we say, for adultery. In many states, adultery would be a civil offense, so that the wife could, in fact, sue her husband and his girlfriend, maybe even, for damages in the event that they had been a, quote, alienation of affection. And so what that did was it didn't wipe out all adultery. Of course it didn't, but it changed the incentive for people to indulge in their desire to have an affair. And if somebody like a therapist or a pastor, somebody could say to a philandering husband, you do realize, buddy, there are some serious consequences to what you're doing. And that would be kind of a wake-up call to this guy that, you know, he could lose his business and a lot of bad things could happen to him. And so that whole conversation can't take place anymore. And so, therefore, a lot of things have changed. Lots of incentives have changed to maintain the marriage or to not maintain the marriage on the part of both parties, I emphasize. It doesn't just change the incentives for the husband, but it's radically changed the incentives for wives as well.
One of the things that seems to have shifted, either it happened before and it was part of the cause, or it happened after, it was part of the effect, when it comes to no-fault divorces, and you mentioned this in part just a moment ago, the general way that we look at marriage, it seems as though legally marriage was always recognized before no-fault divorce as a positive social, moral, and political good. It seems as though no-fault divorce assumes that marriage is, at the very best, morally, politically, and socially neutral.
I think that's exactly right. And the case for no-fault divorce went sort of like this, Todd. The case was, look, why should the state have an interest in keeping together a couple that doesn't want to be together? And the kind of case they had in their mind was a case where there were so-called irreconcilable differences between the man and the wife. They both wanted a divorce. Neither party had committed a fault. Nobody wanted to go into court and tell a lie and say, gosh, my husband's been having an affair, when in fact he hadn't been having an affair. They just wanted to end the marriage. And so, gosh, wouldn't it be easier if we just let these people dissolve their marriage since they both want to? Well, what happened in changing the laws, that case sometimes still happens, of course, but what people didn't anticipate are the number of cases where there is at least where there's one reluctant party, where it's not that they both want to get a divorce and they both agree to it. One party would like to stay married, would like to continue working on the marriage, but the other party unilaterally pulls the plug. And that's why I said in the article that you mentioned in the book, The Meaning of Marriage, I think that the term no-fault divorce is actually quite misleading. I think a better term, a more descriptively accurate term for the change would be to call it unilateral divorce. One party unilaterally can end the marriage for any reason or for no reason. And that has really been the big shift in how we treat it. And you're right. Behind that is the thought that, you know, marriage is kind of a pain in the neck. Marriage is an unacceptable infringement on people's liberty. Those marital obligations are onerous. They're not really very satisfying. And so, gosh, who wouldn't want to get a divorce? Let's make it as easy as possible. And that way of looking at it underestimated how much good a marriage relationship really generates for society, for the children, and indeed for the members of the couple themselves. All of that was swept away or ignored in the change that followed the introduction of unilateral divorce.
We're talking with Jennifer Roback Moore. She's a fellow at the Acton Institute. She taught economics for 15 years at Yale and George Washington University, contributor to a new book titled The Meaning of Marriage. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issues@kfuo.org. In about 20 minutes, we'll be hearing an interview, stopping and starting and getting your reaction during open lines in the last hour of the program with Greg Kokel on the BBC defending his position on abortion. That's coming up here in about 20 minutes on Issues, etc. Well, here's the argument that's often made by the proponents of gay marriage or same-sex unions nowadays. I think Andrew Sullivan has even made this argument. Look, if social and political conservatives believe that marriage is a good, and we've just made the case that it is, then isn't it really a good to have gay couples, lesbian couples, afforded all the rights and privileges of marriage so that they can participate in that institution of society that is so obviously good? How do you respond?
Well, I respond by saying this, that marriage is indeed a great social good, but it's an institution that is fundamentally and profoundly based on gender and based on the gender differences that men and women are brought together by marriage to cooperate in the lifelong business of raising a child and procreation. And that it's, since it is a gender-based institution, the idea that you're going to bring same-sex couples into that same institution, I think Andrew Sullivan and others like him underestimate the kinds of changes that would create within the institution of marriage itself. And so, because what will really happen, Todd, is that marriage will no longer be a gender-based institution. It will be a gender-neutral institution. And in fact, in countries around the world that have introduced same-sex marriage, they have already gone around and changed the birth certificates. People, children, you know, being brought forth in Canada, for example, and in Spain, birth certificates don't say father and mother on them anymore, natural father, natural mother. Birth certificates in Canada say legal parent one, legal parent two. In Spain, the birth certificates say progenitor A, progenitor B. That's what it says, okay? So the idea that mothers and fathers are distinct kinds of beings that have distinct and unique contributions to make, that gets swept away in the change of marriage to accommodate same-sex couples. See, my position is that every legitimate desire that same-sex couples have can be accommodated through contract and the common law, and that to create an institution that is called marriage, that is open to both same-sex couples and opposite-sex couples, is to change the institution of marriage in profound ways. So that is really that's the basis of the case. All of the other arguments that one might make, the particular arguments that one might make, flow from that basic fact, Todd.
When you say that all of the privileges and rights that same-sex couples are looking for can be achieved through contract and common law, are you describing, in essence, same-sex unions?
It depends on what you call it, you know. I mean, a same-sex union, there was a proposal in Colorado not too long ago to create something, and I forget the term that they used for it, but even Dr. Dobson was in favor of this. It was to create a one-stop shopping package where you could designate another person as your partner, and then that person would have power of attorney, that person would have contractual rights over your assets, and you know all of the things in Colorado that two members of a couple could have. They would get it all in one package rather than having to write wills and powers of attorney and all sorts of others, medical power of attorney, visitation rights in the hospital. There would be one document that would solve all of that. And that kind of document, that kind of approach, is saying, look, there's no reason you can't say, you know, I want to leave my property to this person whom I happen not to be married to because he's my same-sex partner, you know. But it's preserving the term marriage for the thing which is unique about marriage, which is that it's a gender-based institution through which we organize procreation and primary sexual activity in this culture.
So basically the case here is that what gay couples or same-sex couples are seeking through gay marriage is already, all those things are already available to them through existing legal institutions.
Yes. With this one exception, what is not available to them through those institutions is social acceptance on the same terms as a straight married couple. And I think, honestly, that is what is driving the desire for same-sex marriage for same-sex unions. It's a self-esteem issue. It's a social acceptance issue, far more than it's about health insurance and visiting people in the hospital, you know. And I think it's much more about being accepted. And that, you know, it seems to me that's not particularly something that we should be sacrificing the whole institution of marriage in order to achieve.
You've mentioned procreation several times here, and there was a time when it was axiomatic that marriage and children go together. I even wrote songs about it and things
right.
like that. Well, that seems to have also been lost,
yes.
perhaps in part due to no-fault divorce. In fact, the illegitimacy rate in some sectors of the population is as high as 25%, and others even higher. And it's growing without a doubt. No one denies that illegitimacy, regardless of people's income, race, background, is growing across the board in the United States. So have we thoroughly disconnected children from family or children from marriage?
Well, that's the attempt. I mean, there are intellectual, academic, and legal institutions in the society that seem to be hell-bent on completely making that disconnect, that marriage is no longer the socially preferred institution either for sex or for childbearing. And that's what marriage is, see? I mean, that's what marriage, if you look across cultures, like across time, marriage is the socially preferred institution, the socially sanctioned institution for both sexual activity and childbearing. Every society has one. They vary in the details of how they organize it and whether you can have men get three wives or one, or, you know, the terms of divorce and all sorts of other things. There's variation in it. But every society has some preferred context in which sexual activity and childbearing takes place. And what the new modern thought is that we don't need any preferred context for sex or childbearing, that anybody can do it any way they want to, any time they want to, with anybody they want to. And what that has done, I think paradoxically for many people, what that has done has been to reduce the power of the civil and private and non-governmental sector of our lives and turn over the power of the family to the family courts, because disputes now have to be handled by the family courts. So if you are a person who, if you're a parent and you're not married, whether you weren't married in the first place or you're divorced, any dispute that you have between you and your child's other parent, that has to get funneled through the family courts. There's no informal social institution, which is what marriage is. So the sort of informal, it has a legal structure around it, but in fact, husbands and wives solve their problems privately inside the home, kicking each other under the table, nudging each other, quarreling in their bedroom, you know, whatever it is, they deal with the disagreements that they have. But now what happens, if the bond between the husband and wife is severed, or between the mother and father is severed, then the disputes have to get adjudicated someplace else. And what happens is the family courts take over. And if you want to hear some unhappy individuals who feel that they are being imposed upon, you just talk to people whose lives are being run by court decree. I mean, in effect, the courts in this country tell people who gets to spend Christmas with their children, you know, and who gets to spend Christmas with them, or who gets to spend Thanksgiving with them. I mean, family court divorce decrees and parenting agreements and so on are specified down to that level of detail. Who gets to pick the kids up from school? All kinds of stuff of this kind that would be outrageous invasions of privacy if it were done under any other, in any other context or under any other rubric. So paradoxically, the breakdown of marriage into a much more individualistic, temporary kind of union has created more intrusions of privacy by the state. I think people believed that by saying, you know, let's let it rip and do whatever we want, that they would end up being more free. But in the end, it's the people inside a functioning marriage who can solve their problems and who get to and who are expected to solve their problems and conflicts on their own. And people who don't have that marital institution wrapped around them, who have given it up or never entered into it, those are the people who have the state breathing down their necks on a regular basis. And people just blow that off like it's nothing, you know, that you could have the court guaranteeing your wages if you're a man, that you could have a court supervising your parenting skills if you're a woman. I mean, it's really quite outrageous invasions of privacy, and nobody bats an eye about it.
Jennifer, with only a few minutes here, then connected, obviously, if in marriage the primary social function of it in a free society is both to act as an institution wherein sex and childbearing, child rearing takes place. What of same-sex adoption, where there are couples who by one means or another have a legal recognition of their union or their marriage, and then they decide, look, even though we're dad and dad or mom and mom, we would like to be dad and dad and mom and mom. We need a kid in this equation. And so we would like to adopt, and we really ought to be able to adopt, because what's the difference? How do you respond to that?
Well, you see, the what's the difference question is really the issue, Todd. And if you say dad and dad are just as good as mom and dad, or mom and mom are just as good as mom and dad, what you're really saying is that gender doesn't matter at all for parenting. The children just need two adults wandering around, and it doesn't matter. The complementarity of the sexes doesn't matter at all to childbearing. So that an adoptive couple that's same-sex versus an adoptive couple that's opposite-sex, there's no reason to expect any differences whatsoever in their parenting. And that is simply false. And I think the studies that purport to show that same-sex couples do just as well as opposite-sex couples, both studies are flawed, virtually every one of them, by either small sample size or improper choice of samples, or by not checking very many variables, by not really studying what they mean by quality of parenting. And so for society to make as a general claim that children do not need either mothers or fathers is to make a really quite radical statement. And it's a statement, I think that is the heart of why it is that America is so resistant to gay marriage, because they know in their bones that there's something not quite right about what is being proposed here. It's not to say that every child of a same-sex couple is going to turn out demented, but it is to say that if you were going to place a bet on how children would fare, the children would fare better. It would be preferable for them to have a mother and a father, to have an opposite-sex parent and a same-sex parent in their household, that is part and parcel of human development. And to assert without proof that you don't need that, or that it's irrelevant, or that it doesn't matter, that's an extremely strong claim that nobody is anywhere close to being able to demonstrate. And I think the American public is quite rightly skeptical of that kind of claim.
Jennifer Roback Morris is a fellow at the Acton Institute. She taught economics for 15 years at Yale and George Washington Universities. And she's a contributor to a new book titled The Meaning of Marriage. Jennifer, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for being our guest.
Thanks very much, Todd.
When we come back from this break, we've got some open lines for your questions and your comments. Now, this is what I'm going to do during open lines. We can talk about anything you want to talk about. We are coming to you live this Monday, the 15th of May, and our call-in numbers, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. For some reason, my call screener's screen says Sunday, May 14th. I don't know how we're one day off, but we are. At least the time's correct. That's all I need. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Did I come into work a day early? Is that what I did? Am I that far off? I shouldn't take those afternoon naps. It's Mother's Day today. Oh, that's odd. I thought I went through that once already yesterday. Well, when we come back, we're going to hear an interview between Greg Kokel and a BBC interviewer. The program's called The Interview. Normally, when Greg Kokel is a guest here on this program, we're talking about any number of things. We often have talked with him about abortion. And if you've listened to those interviews, you know that my questions are usually designed to let Greg make his case as well as he possibly can. And that's one way to hear kind of the prowess of someone who's taught us things like Columbo technique and all of the things that Greg Kokel has laid before us. Well, you want to see him in action, you want to hear him in action, responding to some more hostile questions about his views on abortion. This interview you must hear. We'll stop it and start it. Get your reaction during open lines next. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Open lines after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.